Hello, and welcome to the Green Tea Party,
where we discuss conservative solutions to environmental problems. I'm Hannah Rogers.
My name is Zach Torpy.
And I'm Katie Zakreski. Together, we'll guide you through complex issues and provide strategies to address them,
all while remaining faithful to our conservative values.
Trust me, it'll be a good time.
Yeah, it's a party, so grab your mugs and we'll pour the tea.
Have you guys noticed that spring is starting? Is spring starting where you're at, where I'm at? It's just blooming everywhere. It's so beautiful, except for there's species of tree that's, you know, in Utah, it's kind of like the white flowers or look like popcorn, I guess you could say, but they smell so bad. They reek.
Oh, are they pear blossoms? Is that what it is?
I think they're the crab apple trees, actually.
Mm.
I don't know. I don't know if that's, they produce crab apples. I don't know what the species of the tree is called. But I don't know if they're related to the pear. Maybe they are. But either way, every time I go on a walk, I like hold my breath as I go past these trees in the springtime. And I don't know how it is for you guys, if your flowers are flower smelling and not putrid smelling like the ones in my neighborhood are.
Literally this afternoon, I was like, wow, spring has sprung, because I went to the park. I was at a baby shower on Saturday for 2 hours, and it was outdoors, like at a pavilion in the park. And yesterday I took my dog to the dog park because it was finally warm and dry for the first time in like 6 months. And I honestly didn't want to go home, but I had to do some work. And so I like had to come back home. I was not ready to leave. But today, you better believe I am sneezing up a storm. I've got one heck of a headache. Allergies don't normally bother me, but everything is like yellow right now. But it beats not seeing any leaves or greenery, so you're not going to hear me complaining. I'll keep sneezing.
Yeah.
I love this time of year.
Oh, yeah. Zach, what's it like where you're at?
Oh, it is blazing hot. It's been like in the 80s this
week. It's been in the 80s here. Yeah, it's 80s and humid, too.
Been outside constantly. It's so nice.
I know. It's finally time for me to like fix up my back porch and refill all my feeders and my little bug hotel and stuff. So,
yeah, bug hotel?
Yeah, it's like, I don't even know how to describe it. It looks like hollow bamboo shoots, and they're like all packed together, like within a frame, and bugs can like burrow inside there and like hibernate and rest and like, I guess, not be rained on and stuff. And so I've got one of those on my back porch. I've got several bird feeder cameras, squirrel feeders, bird feeders, little ponds. I'm going to try to get like a little bumblebee, like honeybee fountain set up to where they can like land on marbles in a dish of sugar water and like drink it. I'm trying to grow mushrooms back there. I'm pretty sure everybody thinks I'm insane when they walk.
Okay, it sounds like you're trying to become a.
I'm just trying to be a Disney hobbit, princess. Man. Yeah, I'm going to be a Disney princess or a hobbit. So check back in.
I'm all about it.
Yeah, I'll let you know what my shoe size is, and maybe we'll have a definitive answer by then. But yeah, spring has finally sprung. My environmentalist little heart is so happy about it.
Yeah. Sounds like you're building like a little fairy. Okay, yeah, so I have a question about spring. Have you guys noticed any changes in your lifetime in terms of what spring looks like the timing, the heat, the amount of precipitation? Like, what do you guys think about that?
Yeah, I was just telling somebody the other day that this was like the strangest spring ever. And maybe it's because like we had a real big snow this year, and that's very rare for us. But I felt like I was really done with winter a lot earlier this year than I have been before mentally, where I was like in February, I was like, bro, I'm over it. Let's see some greenery. I want to wear t-shirts. But it's been like a real cold spring. That groundhog lied to us. It has been a real cold spring. It only just this week started feeling like spring and looking like spring. I feel like for the last month or so, I've been looking at the branches like, come on, any day now. But that's like the first year I've noticed that.
Yeah, what about you, Zach? What do you think about the springs that you've been experiencing?
Well, I have a different perspective since I moved from New York to Colorado. But this spring, it's interesting seeing the like false starts in Colorado where it's like 65 one weekend, then it snows a foot the next like week. And it's like 65 again. And it's like, what is going on here? pick a rhythm.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I wonder what is specific about the geography of Arkansas and Colorado that makes the springs the way that they are, especially in response to modern climate change. So how my spring has been is I feel like every year it gets really hot earlier and earlier, and it's really like dumps lots of water, and then we don't see any precipitation until winter time. So, I mean, there's some summer storms, but they're very few and far between, maybe one for the rest of the year. But have you guys noticed maybe the blossoms have been blossoming earlier, or that the springs are more quiet than they used to be? Because I remember when I was growing up in rural Utah, it was just like all spring I heard birds chirping and lightning bugs and crickets and all these things. Once spring started, you knew because of how loud and how active the animals and the insects were. But now it's very quiet. I mean, I guess Rachel Carson puts it best. It's slowly becoming a more silent spring.
Mm. Excellent pun, by the way. Excellent pun, by the way, there.
I know. Thank you. That's a great pun. That was an excellent pun. Or an excellent pun.
Excellent. All right. That's two strikes and we're only a few minutes. We're all just right, right, down there. Or do you have one more you want to get out of your system?
I don't know. I mean, we'll see how this episode progresses. I might have some.
Yeah, are you like frantically flipping through flashcards right now with environmental puns on them?
I mean, I did write this episode, so okay, I was thinking about puns.
The note cards are on standby.
But yeah, I don't know how you guys feel about, like, I used to have a robin's nest that would, you know, regularly be robins that would nest at my house. And now, you know, I maybe see a few birds, but it's because birds are seriously affected by springtime and climate change, because climate change affects the timing of spring and the temperatures of spring. And because these birds rely on these predictable patterns to be nesting, and these patterns are changing, they're dying or they're moving. And so you're going to start seeing more and more strange springs, I guess I could say, and also back again, silent springs. So, yeah.
It's interesting. Go ahead, Zach. I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead.
I was going to say, from my experience in New York, it was, as I grew up, I definitely saw the, or heard the difference in when I would go out at night during the spring, because we used to have just so many peepers around and crickets. It would just be like alive with noise. It'd be like wonderful to go to sleep to and kind of annoying in the morning. But
yeah,
you don't hear that anymore. It's very different.
Mm-mm, no. So what this episode is about is I really wanted to dive into the history of climate change as a science, mostly because I don't really want to, you know, try to convince anyone of the scientific arguments around climate change, because if you're tuning into Green Tea Party Radio, you're probably already on board, or, you know, I just don't feel like it's important for us to be, you know, explaining the science to people, because it kind of sounds patronizing. But I really feel like it's interesting to shed light on the ins and outs, the kind of like the failures, some of the interesting discoveries, all that stuff around climate change and climate science, and how we got to where we are with our understanding of anthropogenic climate change. So I really hope, also another thing is, I feel like in my career so far, because it's both been very political and very scientific, on the scientific side, they have very little idea of how to communicate this to the average person. Because, you know, scientists, we love them, we adore them, but they're kind of nerdy, kind of introverted. They don't really like to speak up, you know, because that's just kind of the personality that's drawn to like getting a doctorate degree, you know? And unfortunately, that kind of hinders making this really crucial science applicable to the public, because they just sometimes don't always have those communication skills. And so I really wanted to go through and talk about some of the early climate scientists and maybe help humanize these people who've just kind of been locked away in their ivory tower, if that makes sense.
I think that's a great idea. That's awesome.
Yeah. So I guess I can just dive right in. So you guys comment along the way. Ask me questions. I'll ask you guys questions, but I hope the listeners as well reach out and ask some questions about this too. So the thing that I love about climate science is that understanding Earth systems is an enormous undertaking, because the Earth is enormous and it's also changing very fast. And it's, you know, the climate science and Earth sciences as a whole they're very old fields, if that makes sense, but they're also very new, because a lot of the techniques that we use to understand Earth's climate have only been developed since the 20th century with like satellites and things like that. And since it's an enormous undertaking, it takes a lot of people, a lot of resources. And so most of the time, the people who are on the ground who are making this science happen are regular people. Like the kind of the ivory tower professors, the doctors are few and far between, because it just requires so many people. And those people usually have a couple of extra free hours and a love for the planet. So they're willing to volunteer their time to, you know, go out and collect environmental samples or to run experiments or to volunteer in a lab. And this kind of like citizen and community engaged science is super critical. And it's kind of interesting because the first person who discovered the greenhouse gas effect was an amateur like citizen scientist who was really just interested in how different gases could impact the air, the temperature of air. Her name was Eunice Foote. She was an American women's rights advocate and kind of a developing scientist. And in 1856, she made the discovery that would lay the groundwork for the rest of climate science. And what she did was she filled a bunch of airtight tubes with different gases. And then in each of those tubes, she had a mercury thermometer. And then she just placed them in direct sunlight. And she observed how these different gases affected the air temperature inside of these airtight containers. And the interesting thing that she noticed is that the hottest and the most rapidly warming airtight containers were the ones that had humid water in it. So they're very humid. And above all, the one that was most consistently warm was one that had the highest concentration of carbon dioxide. Zach and Katie, I'm sure you're like very familiar with like the difference between like carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas and water as a greenhouse gas. So do either of you guys want to explain that for our listeners who might not be as familiar with it?
I'm not a scientist. I'm not a scientist. So swing for the fences.
Should I explain? I feel like maybe that was a little bit of an intense question to ask.
I guess I'm trying to think of like the chemical structure of carbon that makes it such a greenhouse gas.
Or like any guesses that you guys might think.
I know they have very strong bonds, so they're hard to break.
Carbon dioxide
gas. That's why they last so long in the atmosphere.
Well,
So
the answer is actually, Zach, you're pretty close to it. So carbon dioxide has a much longer residency time in the atmosphere than water does, if that makes sense. So water clouds actually have a really significant warming effect, and water vapor does. But the thing is, when water evaporates into the atmosphere, it only stays in the atmosphere for max a couple of days, right?
So I was right. You're welcome, nonsense.
Yes, you were right, Katie.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'll be at the bar if you... No, I'm just kidding. I will take my engineer's license now, or my scientist's white coat. Is that easy, folks?
What carbon dioxide does is it could have a residency time if it's not sequestered, which is means that it's drawn out of the atmosphere through photosynthesis, of thousands of years. It can stay and it can have that warming potential for years. So that's why people are really concerned about carbon dioxide, is because it just doesn't naturally come out of the atmosphere. There is a process, a geologic process where with silicates, where there's a chemical interaction between rocks and the atmosphere that does sequester carbon, but that's very slow. It's very minimal. And so the best way to manage carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is to just prevent it from getting there in the first place. Okay, so back to the science. So Eunice Foote, she was an American female scientist. And at the time, Britain kind of had a monopoly of intellect. And it was just a bunch of British male scientists who were kind of like this old boys club who was like a little bit elitist. Think about like Charles Darwin, any of those people at the time who made like very significant contributions to science, but they were also very exclusive on who they would allow to participate in science. And so when she tried to get her work published, she actually had to have her male colleague present it. And it was really just overlooked because they were like, oh, look, an American, these dumb Americans trying to do science. And they ignored her work. Isn't that terrible? Like,
great British accent.
I wasn't even trying at the time. But it was interesting because at the time, these prestigious institutions that were holding these scientific forums, like Cambridge and Oxford, were like meticulously taking daily atmospheric temperature measurements and really trying to understand like the weather, the environment, the climate. And here comes this person who has a really good explanation for why the planet is so warm and hospitable to life, which is the greenhouse gas effect. And they just you know, tossed it aside because they were American. How unfortunate is that? And actually, two decades later, a British male scientist named John Tyndall came along and saw Eunice Foote's work, and he repeated the experiments and then took credit for them. Then all of a sudden, all these scientific academies were paying attention to what they had to say, which is just terrible. Like, oh my gosh. You guys know the scandal with the female scientist who discovered DNA? Like, it's the same thing. Like, she was discredited because she wasn't a man and she wasn't British. So kind of like science, it can't be exclusionary for it to be truly science. So then the next discovery came from another citizen scientist. His name is actually Guy Stewart Callender, which I just love the name Guy. I don't know if you've ever met anyone.
Too. I love that name.
It's such a cute name. It's like a
50s name. It's really cute. It's nostalgic. Yes,
it is nostalgic. So in 1938, Guy quit his day job because he was so passionate about understanding what he'd been observing, which was the Earth warming. Back in 1938, that's almost 100 years ago. I mean, that's like, what, 80-ish years ago? 83, something like that? I don't know. Correct me on my math. I'm not very good at that off the top of my head. But he noticed that the planet was warming a little bit, and he wanted to prove it scientifically. So what he did is he found himself looking at ship logs, weather stations, universities, governments, anything that he could find about what the global temperature was like. And he did it in a way that was geographically diverse. So he was collecting data from South America, North America, Australia, as many places as he possibly could. And for doing some pretty crude calculations and also not having super good tools, he was able to do some pretty incredible science. And he didn't have very much education, but what he did really laid the groundwork for the rest of climate science. And another crazy thing is he was also taking daily measurements of carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere. And he was shocked to notice that carbon dioxide concentrations, as they were increasing, there was a bit of a correlation between carbon dioxide concentrations increasing and global average temperature increasing. And another thing to note about Guy Stewart Callender is that he was after the age of industrialization, whereas Eunice Foote was during the age of industrialization. And there's also the first industrialized war, World War I, that had just happened that dumped tons of carbon dioxide emissions into the atmosphere. And he was just around the start of the World War II when he started doing these experiments. So he was really close to a time when there was unprecedented levels of CO2 emissions in the atmosphere. And in fact, Guy measured that the world collectively warmed by 0.3 degrees Celsius just from these two world wars. That's crazy.
That's really impressive. The impact humanity can have.
I know. And I feel like it's so funny because whenever I say, oh, 0.1 degrees Celsius, 0.3 degrees Celsius, you guys probably get this. They're like, oh, that doesn't sound significant. It's like, well, yes, but that's on average. And some places like the Arctic and the Antarctic could be warming as much as 10 degrees Celsius, while other places might not be warming that quickly. And a global average warming of 0.3 degrees, that's a lot. And it can sometimes be, I don't want to, scare people, but if it keeps getting out of control, it could reach levels that are dangerous. And we got to be very careful to avoid that. So the next person who came along and made a discovery is someone that you guys might be familiar with. Are you guys familiar with Charles D. Keeling? Maybe?
Only from reading about climate science a little bit.
Ah, yes. he got the Presidential Medal of Freedom from Bush, I think. I'm just kind of a fan of Charles D. Keeling because he took a look at all of this landmark science that had happened for him. And he proposed to his PhD advisor that he wanted to explore the link between carbon emissions and temperature on a global scale. No one had ever done that before. And up until this point, which, it was in the 1950s, climate change had all been hypothetical, theoretical. People were kind of raising the alarm bells, but since there wasn't, satellites and other things, scientists were there is a potential that if things did continue warming and carbon dioxide concentrations got out of control, it could be catastrophic. They were aware of that, but it was always hypothetical. And no one had proved that climate change was something that we should actively be working to mitigate because of how serious it could possibly get until Charles Keeling came along. And his advisor, when he proposed to make this his dissertation on the link between carbon emissions and temperature on a global scale, his advisor told him not to do it. He said, it's not a worthwhile pursuit. You're not going to be, you know, making any significant contributions into climate science. But Charles Keeling knew better and he ignored him and said, you know what? I'm going to move to Mauna Loa, Hawaii, and I'm going to make daily measurements of carbon dioxide and daily measurements of temperature and see how both of those things are increasing.
Hey, pursue your dreams.
Yeah. And I'm going to throw another hypothetical scientific question at you guys. Why do you guys think it was important to set up a carbon dioxide concentration measuring station in Mauna Loa, Hawaii? Why do you think that was the best place to do it?
I'm guessing there was no very limited human impact around a, I don't know how active volcano, but pretty remote, high up.
Yes.
Just natural atmosphere.
Yes, exactly. Because that at that point where they're measuring carbon dioxide, they can assume that the atmosphere that they're measuring is very well mixed and very homogeneous. So if he was like taking a measurement, you know, on the streets of New York, he might have a higher measurement of carbon dioxide than if he's taking a measurement in the Amazon rainforest. And since it's a not super vegetated area, he knows that there's not a lot of vegetation that's sequestering the carbon. It's the middle of the ocean. And he also knows that there's not a lot of people there, so there's not a lot of people producing carbon dioxide emissions. So it's a pretty good, you know, place to find a uniform atmosphere. So what he noticed and what he created was something called the Keeling curve, which you guys are also probably familiar with. So the Keeling curve is this curve, global CO2 emissions going up, and it kind of has this oscillation. In the script, you guys can see it. So do you guys know why there's this oscillation between, like throughout every year, why it goes up and down for global carbon dioxide concentrations?
Do you want to go?
Wild.
I'm guessing. A writer. I don't know anything. I see a chart and I'm scared. I'm having ACT flashbacks.
The ACT. I remember those days. I hated the ACT.
Oh my God. No. Anytime they looked at a chart, I felt my IQ plummet and toward my shoes. So, I see this chart and it's a beautiful chart. I can't tell you anything about this chart.
I see.
So it's the breathing of the earth based on like when plants are growing and when they're sort of going to like hibernation, like during the winter, right?
Yes. So,
dude, that's metal as exactly well. That is so cool.
That is metal. So actually, so you know how there's more land mass in the northern hemisphere than in the southern hemisphere? So Antarctica, I guess you could count it's a land mass, but it's completely glaciated and it does have some vegetation, but not very much. In the northern hemisphere, when those plants wake up, they sequester all that carbon in the summer and the spring. So it draws down global carbon just temporarily. And then in the wintertime, when all those plants go into hibernation and some of them die and decay, global carbon dioxide concentrations go back up, if that makes sense. So I thought that was metal as hell, to repeat exactly what you said, Katie, when I heard this. I was like, oh my gosh, that's so interesting. Because I would always see this chart. And I'm like, I don't know what the wiggle's for. It's wiggling for some reason, and I don't know why. It's
respiration, now we know.
Yes, exactly. It is cellular respiration. So I thought that was super cool. And Charles D. Keeling actually did end up winning the Presidential Medal of Freedom for this. And he set up, and his laboratory in Mauna Loa is still going on today. Obviously, he has way more sophisticated measurements than he did today, but at first it was literally just him and like a makeshift weather station that he created himself. And I feel like talking about Eunice Foote and Guy Callender Stewart and Charles D. Keeling is just so cool to me, because these are like regular people, and I love the fact that like regular people are engaging in science, because it shouldn't be intimidating, but the people in science sometimes like look down at their nose at people and are like, oh, you wouldn't understand. I'm published in three prestigious journals. It's just like academia has a little bit of a cult-like mentality. And so it makes people feel a little excluded. And that's really bad for the scientific process, if that makes any sense. I don't know if that's how you guys have ever felt taking a scientific class, but even though my degree is a scientific degree and I'm just about to wrap it up, I felt really intimidated sometimes and I was made to feel stupid. And that's really sad, if that makes any sense.
Well, and I could go on for days about, you know, take this with a grain of salt. But I think a whole lot of people who are professors act like they're doing a lot of good for the common good, when in reality, you got to pay $50 to access any article they've ever written. You got to pay $200 to read their textbook. And that's not even touching, you know, like the cost of going to school. So I feel like a lot of professors, not all, but I feel like a lot of professors act like, oh my gosh, I'm fighting for the common good and for the underdog. And then you got to pay like $500 to read anything they've ever written. So it's like nobody gives a shit. Nobody gives a shit how many degrees you have or where you got them. Nobody cares. like full stop. Nobody cares. How is what you're doing helping humankind?
Exactly. And Katie, I feel you so much there. And like, as someone who's, you know, trying to participate in the scientific community, but also trying to like make science accessible, you face kind of like a little bit of an uphill battle, because people believe that like somehow scientists are like this elite class of
gods, eggheads, you're so brilliant,
who are God's gift to humanity. But literally, the history of climate change science shows that like these are regular people who were literally just like, oh, I'm going to put different gases in tubes and set them in sunlight. I want to see what it does. Like, anyone can do that. And you, like, all of our listeners should feel like if they want to do something like that, that it's valuable, because it could lead to something incredible. And so many times it has. And I feel like it's so funny, because in like up until the 1970s, when climate change became kind of in the forefront of our collective conscious, none of these prestigious institutions, none of these, you know, academic weapons, as they would say, were paying attention to this kind of science. But once, you know, Charles D. Keeling was like winning all these, you know, scientific accolades, they were like, oh, I want to get in on that. It's like, well, you're late to the, you know, kind of late to the party, because, you know, we've been doing this for a while.
Well, and let's not sugarcoat it, but a lot of professors and scientists at that point were busy being pinko commies instead of trying to figure out how what they were doing could be accessible and help everybody without boosting their own ego. So
they're busy focusing on, you know, like what they can do to be remembered, or, you know, what their legacy is going to be, rather than just focusing on the science. And actually, I'm currently in a critique class for a climate science class where we go through and critique climate science papers. And one of the interesting things that we'll say is there are a lot of scientists who, you know, kind of contradict the scientific process of going in with a hypothesis, and then instead of trying to dismantle that hypothesis and prove it wrong, they go in with the intention to prove it right. But that's not how the scientific process works. You're going to come up with a hypothesis, and you're going to say, okay, I'm going to do everything in my whole power to tear this hypothesis apart, right? But regular people who don't have those inflated egos, who don't have this vested interest in, you know, having as many citations on their paper as possible, or getting published in Nature, can do this kind of really landmark science because they're not letting their egos get in the way, you know?
Well, and even to take that one step further, Hannah, you don't, and I'm going to be careful when I say this, not everybody can be a scientist, okay? But I think everybody can follow the scientific method. I don't want to, for me, scientist is like that word brave or hero. Not everybody can be a hero, okay? Because you did one cool or good thing. They're obviously, scientists are in a certain category because they are, you know, doing rigorous things that are far beyond what I'm capable of doing. But if you follow the scientific method and you've got a hypothesis and you find out something, whether it's right or wrong, whether you've proven or disproven your hypothesis, you've contributed to that field. If you've done everything correctly, because even if you do something and you're way off the ball, way out of the ballpark, they know not to repeat that and waste their time repeating that. Scientists, generally speaking, in the scientific community. So I think I think to prove your point, Hannah, a lot of scientists are like, oh, I'm a good scientist if my hypothesis is proven or like, dude, how about you just carry out the experiment and no matter what the outcome is, you've contributed to science. Like you get that's a medal actually, just for showing up, man.
Yes. And another thing is the papers that disprove the hypothesis are, like you just said, are way more important than the papers that, you know, prove a hypothesis.
Because there are stories. And so I mean, and there are stories of scientists who go to conventions who are like their whole presentation is, here's how I was wrong. Here's how I was 150% wrong. Here's what I did that was wrong. Here was the result that I got. I'm admitting to you all that I was wrong. And they get standing ovations. Because they find out, like, on the way there, oh my gosh, this glaring error. Well, I'm going to talk anyway. I read a story about this here a couple of years ago. I think it was in relation to, and maybe, who knows? I've slept since then, whatever. But it was in relation to that one scientist who, okay, way crazy tangent here. Do y'all remember the scientist who, like, maybe it was a scientist, I don't know. Anywho, they, like, took a picture of, like, salami, and they were like, this is Jupiter. And like they were a scientist, I'm not kidding. I swear to you, I'm not making this up. It was like a slice.
Wait, I'm gonna Google this. What the heck?
So serious. It was like a slice of deli meat, and they're like Jupiter and its moons, and like all of these scientists were like freaking out about it. And somebody from NASA was like, "That is a slice of salami." Like some like and in the article, that article no. that talked about that. Yes, I'm dead serious. See, I'm not crazy. I'm not crazy. Thank you. Like in that one of those articles, there was an example of a scientist who was like. Doing a lot of astronomy work and had been completely wrong about a planet's moon and presented it at a conference. I got a standing ovation. Like he wasn't expecting it. He was way nervous about it. He was like, well, I'm not going to cancel. I'm already on the plane there. And just like gave his talk about why he was wrong. And got a standing ovation because everybody in the room was like, it is so rare for a scientist to be able to fully 110% admit that they were wrong and share that with people like without a problem.
Why? Why would he make it lunch meat? Oh my gosh. Yeah, he's like this so I Googled it and you're like, it looks like Jupiter, but what he said is that it was like a distant new star.
That's what it was. I couldn't remember what it was. I remember he was like, yeah, doing something like that where he tried to make it seem like he'd made this cool discovery and somebody from NASA was like, that is salami. Slice of meat as planet. I'm
salami gay. Oh my god.
I literally, I'm not even kidding you, for a good 10 seconds before I said this stuff out loud, I was like, did I dream this? Or did this happen?
No, you did not. It's real.
Kind of like when I dreamed that Charlotte the Stingray had her babies. I was like, okay, we're going to gamble on this one again.
Well, one thing that I feel like I should say is you, all of us probably know one or two people who don't believe in climate change, right? Like, I know several
people. Some of us might be related to people who don't believe in climate change.
Yeah, it's some of us are personally very close with those people. But having and contextualizing those kinds of skepticism with the way that the scientific community has treated the general public kind of makes sense, you know? Like, you know, get this vaccine. We're not going to tell you why. You know, it's like, well, yeah, like maybe they could do a better job of explaining the scientific process so that people actually get on board. It's like, we need to, you know, you need to put solar panels on your house. Well, why? Shut up. Take it. You know, it's like, it's like you're dumb little, you know, non-academic, like, listen to us. It's like, of course, people are going to be skeptical. Of course, because they didn't do a very good job of explaining and they didn't do it very compassionately. So, of course, they're not going to be wanting to listen to scientific people. But here's another thing, though, is scientists themselves are also normal people. Most of us, I mean, I'm not a scientist yet, but I would like to be in the future. You know, we're just regular people who are also somewhat very stupid a lot of the time. And that's a good thing. We need to have stupid scientists. We need to have regular people involved. We need to have people who have humility because then it just like breaks apart this ivory tower-esque, like, oh, you know, I went to Harvard. You wouldn't understand. It's like, well, really, this whole thing is just pageantry, you know?
Like, well, for the rest of us who can't even afford to buy a Harvard sweatshirt, We're gonna.
Yes. There's so much elitism too. Oh my gosh, you are touching it on the nose, Katie. Like it's so classist. Like it's like, ah, oh, you know, like, you know, you're like, my dad donated a building to like this institution, so now I can feel better about myself. It's like, it's just, I see that and I understand like people who are outside of the scientific community being frustrated with the scientific community, because, you know, I'm in here and I'm frustrated, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's aside. I just wanted to go through then those are like the first three really big discoveries. Was Eunice Foote, regular person. Guy Callender Stewart, regular person. And actually, Charles de Keeling, he was getting his PhD, but he was also a very regular person. And he was told not to try and invest in this, you know, dissertation because his academic advisor didn't think it was worthwhile. But then once climate change became this like hot topic, all these eggheads co-opted it. And like, come on. Either way, so then in 1968, John Mercer, he was a glaciologist at Ohio State University, and he made observations on how the warming trend proposed by Charles de Keeling and in the Keeling curve could raise sea levels by making the West Antarctic ice sheet unstable. And so that's kind of where the sea level rise hypothesis comes from and ties in with with global warming as a whole. And then in 1969, NASA finally used its satellites and launched a satellite into the atmosphere. I think it has a very particular biblical sounding name. I can't remember what the satellite was called right now. But it used its satellites to measure Earth's temperature and Earth's climate for the very first time. And satellites are really cool because I am a huge fan of satellites. They take a lot of emissions to get in the atmosphere, a lot of work. But the scientific research that we can get from these satellites, ugh. It's so cool. It's so precise. And they're also like making measurements 12 times a day. So we can see every 2 hours how Earth's climate is changing and how much carbon dioxide emissions are in the atmosphere, how much sulfur dioxide emissions are in the atmosphere using these satellites. They're so, so, so cool. And it also makes it so that we can see the whole Earth versus Gaia Stewart Callender had to spend like years hiking around the whole globe, trying to find as much data as he possibly could. But a satellite can do that in 2 hours, you know? So that's huge. Really big fan of satellites. And also, speaking of which, for my listeners, I got a job offer at NASA.
No way.
I did.
Are you going to go work for them? Are you the newest NASA scientist I know and NASA scientist host of Green Tea Party Radio?
Maybe. I don't know. I have a few different job offers, but I just received
Hannah,
an offer.
Is it going to be anywhere as near as cool as working for NASA? Okay, how about you go work for NASA, and if you can get me a nice swagalicious Space Force or NASA outfit, okay. Can we get NASA to sponsor Green Tea Party Radio?
Ladies and gentlemen,
we don't have any organizational sponsor except possibly NASA. NASA sponsor y'all's podcast? No?
Right. So that's a very random aside. I was that not is expecting. Awesome. Yeah, I got a job to help rehabilitate pine tree species in the Western Rocky Mountains. So that's what we're doing.
That is so cool.
And I'll be using satellites to understand Earth's environment, which is super
very cool.
That is so dope. Talking about NASA satellites, I'm like, wait, I'm about to have a job using NASA satellites. So I'll be like, projects around that. Yeah, super random, but very excited about that.
If they need anybody to write copy for them, you just let me know, buddy.
I will mention, I'll be like, do you need someone who is very good at cracking good jokes and writes good? I know a few people.
Who talks too much? Yeah.
Yeah. Then we got into, you know, NASA with these climate science, these satellites to understand climate science. And then we get into paleoclimatology. We can do another episode on paleoclimatology. We'll have a part two on this because paleoclimatology is a really interesting emerging scientific field that uses climate proxies left behind to understand Earth's past. These proxies are like bubbles of air trapped in Antarctic ice sheets, pollen proxies, lake bed proxies, isotopic records from ocean floors, fossilized stomata from leaves that get fossilized, and many more proxies. They're super cool, and they help us understand something called Milankovitch cycles. So that's a little bit of a taste for a part two episode that is coming shortly. But ultimately, this field is an emerging one. And I hope this episode has demonstrated that there are changes that are occurring in climate science, and we're developing a really sophisticated understanding of how the Earth's climate, you know, operates. But like people, like climate scientists, like all of us, we're just regular, like scientists are just regular people, and they tend to make mistakes. And sometimes they're a little evil and try to name a star salami after themselves.
Absolutely.
But that doesn't mean that the science that's already been done is invalid or is not true, because that has withstood the test of time. And that's the most important thing. So for the action steps, I want you to write your member of Congress and let them know that you're a young conservative that supports a carbon price. And also, there's a book that I want you guys to read. It's called This Changes Everything. It's by Naomi Klein. She's a phenomenal climate journalist, and she also really goes through kind of like the historical and scientific background around climate change and then what we can do going forward. And when you write your member of Congress, make sure to go to house.gov and enter your zip code to find your member of Congress in the House of Representatives, or go to senate.gov to find your senators. And also, don't forget to tweet us at Green Tea Party Radio and tell us what your favorite scientist and climate scientist is, if you have any of those. So yeah.
For you, our listener, email us with your thoughts. Our email is info@greenteapartyradio.com. Thank you for listening to Green Tea Party Radio, and a very special thank you to all our patrons. We couldn't do this without you. If you're interested in getting early access to episodes as well as Green Tea Party Radio merch, check us out at greenteapartyradio.com. If you have feedback, tell us what's on your mind, and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok.
And just so you know, this is our passion project. We don't have any organizational sponsor. And a friendly reminder that Green Tea Party Radio is not representative of the Diocese of Little Rock, Catholic Climate Covenant, or any of our employers. Not even NASA, unfortunately. We're building a movement.
Not because NASA.
We'll get there, though.
Not yet.
We're building a movement because we want the world to know that conservatives, and particularly young conservatives, have really important things to say about climate change.
Oh, yeah, that's me. And if you want to hear us on your college radio station, email us at info@greenteapartyradio.com and give us the details about your campus and your radio station. That email is, again, info@greenteapartyradio.com. Okay, guys, thanks for letting me be a really nerdy and it was kind of a long episode, but it happens. There's a lot of ground to cover.
On
this field is kind of all over the place sometimes. So I'm glad that you guys indulged me in my nerdiness. And I hope I didn't catch you off guard too much with my random science questions.
I learned something. Yay.
Yay. I always learn something from you guys. So I'm glad that I was able to share this time.
You will always learn something from Green Tea Party Radio.
We're so informative. All right. Yeah. Bye.
Yeah. Thanks for listening.